My name is Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
A Rayo Original Podcast.
A lot of people think change is difficult. Change is really easy when you know how. I've seen people change in seconds. All day long, we're moving towards or away from things by the pictures and movies we make inside our mind and the way we make them.
The way that you feel about something, the visualizations you have, the narrative you're telling yourself, the movies in your mind, as you put it, they do absolutely become self-fulfilling prophecies. You're so right. Defining ourselves really blocks us from actually finding out who we are and all that we can be.
See, to me, powerful change is another day at the office. But I understand to a lot of people, they think it's magic. Very often there's a block, right? And it'll be at the unconscious level, so you won't know why. Open your eyes and come on back out.
Wow. Hello and welcome back to Rise with Roxy. Today, we are talking about real change, not surface level motivation, not quick fixes, but the kind of inner shift that actually lasts. I am joined by world-renowned hypnotherapist, behavioral scientist, and best-selling author, Dr. Paul McKenna. Paul's books have sold over 10 million copies worldwide, been translated into 32 languages, and have helped millions of people change their lives from the inside out. Nearly 25 years ago, Paul revolutionized self-help with Change Your Life in 7 Days. Now, he's back with a fully updated version, blending neuroscience, hypnosis, mindset, and spirituality to reflect what we now understand about how the mind really works. In this episode, we're diving into why people feel stuck, how self-sabotage really forms, what manifestation actually requires to work, and how to take simple, practical, daily steps to become the most confident and aligned version of yourself. By the end of this conversation, you will understand how to stop fighting your mind and start running it. Before we begin, please don't forget to like, subscribe, and comment. New guest episodes are every Monday, and my solo episodes are every Thursday. Okay, now let's rise with Paul McKenna. Paul McKenna, what an honor to have you on Rise with Roxy. I have followed your work since I can remember. You are a household name, have been such an inspiration to me in my own journey. And I'm honest, I couldn't be happier to have you here.
Well, the feeling is mutual because, you know, I've admired your work. I mean, I absolutely love and tell everybody to read Manifest. It's a superb book, beautifully written, leaves you feeling up. So, you know, it's really lovely to meet you as well.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm like, I want to start with asking you, what do you think is the biggest lie that people believe about themselves that keeps them from changing their life?
Yes, a really interesting question that. I think a lot of people think change is difficult, right? And that's usually because they've tried with willpower. And, you know, it takes a lot of effort, doesn't it? You know, using willpower to stay on a diet or, you know, to quit smoking or to, you know, to try and force yourself to be confident when you don't feel confident, that sort of thing. And actually, change is really easy when you know how, right? So about half of what we do each day is a habit, right? We don't think, shall I tie my shoelaces or brush my teeth? We just do it, yeah? And many of the habits we have support us, you know, like opening doors, shaking hands, you know, they're neat things, right? Driving a car. And some of the habits that we pick up along the way are unhelpful. So overeating, smoking, feeling unnecessarily anxious, etc. Those things can be changed quite easily using things like hypnosis and modern psychological techniques like NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. So yeah, the thing that people tell themselves or get convinced about is change is hard. And often it takes a long time as well, you know. And I say, look, I've seen people change in seconds. You know, they've just got to a point in their life where they go, that's it, I'm never going to do that again. And in that moment, their life changes. Or they have an idea suddenly for the direction of their career, where they're going to go. And in that moment, their life changes. Or they meet a particular person, and in that moment, their life changes. So the lie is that change is hard. Change takes a long time and it's difficult.
You know, I couldn't agree more, because people often say to me, you know, if I learn to manifest, how long will it take to see change? And I always say change is instant. It's getting to the point where you make a decision to change that takes the longest. But once you've made the decision that I am going to change, or I am going to do something differently, then it happens straight away.
I totally agree with you. I think that's one of the things that you have as a human being is choice. And, you know, people say to me, oh, no, I've got no choice. And then through a process of questions, they'll realize, oh, actually, there are always choices available to us. But it is in that moment when you commit that you really connect with your power. And that's the difference that makes the difference.
I'm sure all of us have a person in our lives, or perhaps we've done it ourselves, where we've had a friend, let's say, come to us with a problem, and maybe it's a problem they've complained about over and over again. And as much as you will say, why don't you try this? Why don't you try that? They will always find an excuse for it. And it seems that for so many people, what they will do is absolutely resist change. They will resist doing something differently. Why is that happening, and why, and is it something that the brain is doing, or is it something that is conscious?
Well, usually the reason people repeat a particular dysfunctional behavior over and over again is because there's something called secondary gain, right? So for example, the secondary gain in smoking is that the crude chemicals in a cigarette create an endorphin release, so they actually calm you down. So as a stress control mechanism, smoking's effective. It's just got a massive negative long-term health consequence. If it's, say, self-sabotage in maybe relationships, early in my dating career, I had my heart broken a couple of times. And so my unconscious mind is trying to overprotect me. So it would either search out people, you know, that wouldn't be suitable, so I couldn't fall in love with them. Or it would sabotage it if I felt like I was. It would go, oh, no, we can't have this, because love equal pain. Because the unconscious mind is not logical. It's purposeful. The thing is that we get kind of programmed, if you like, early on in life. One of my favorite stories is there was a guy that came to see me early on when I started out in the 1980s. And every time he started to get successful, he sabotaged it. He stopped it. And yet he knew consciously he was doing it, but he couldn't stop himself. Now, I wouldn't do it like this these days, but in those days, I was an old school hypnotherapist. So I put him into a trance and I regressed him and I sent him to the time when this first happened. And what had occurred is he'd said to his mother when he was a little boy, when I grow up, I want to be successful. And she went, oh, son, you don't want that. Most successful people, they have heart attacks. Now, small, impressionable person, authority figure, saying something with emotional intensity, bam, goes straight into his unconscious with the power of hypnotic suggestion, right? So, see, the unconscious is not logical. It's purposeful. Its purpose is survival. And so, as soon as he started to get successful, his unconscious mind went, oh, this could be life-threatening. We better stop this. So a lot of time that people are repeating the same mistake over and over again is not conscious. It's at the unconscious. And usually it's just bad programming. You know, people, I say this to people, you know, to say if they're they have a particular problem, I say, it's not your fault. It's the fault of your programming, you know, and nobody's born wanting a cigarette. You know, you have to learn and force yourself to do that, you know, behind the bike sheds at school or something. In fact, you know, if you think about it, Roxy, basically everyone in the world is changing how they feel by some external means. Mm-hmm. Drinking, drug taking, gambling, sex, shopping, television, and food, particularly sugar food, mm-hmm. you know. And so there isn't like some perfect person, you know, who has all the answers and has it all together. We're all just doing the best we can. Mm-hmm. Some people are doing better than others.
When do you think it starts, this kind of using external things to change how we feel? Sort of, are children doing that as well, or does it start later?
Sure, absolutely. You know, children nowadays, you know, it's will change how they feel by being addicted to their phone or by computer games mm-hmm. or something like that. But it could also be junk food. It could be, you know, sweets or whatever. That was what it was in my day, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, if mummy and daddy do something like that, you know, and you're small and impressionable, and you go, oh, okay, I change, you know, the way I feel, you know, by the same way that mum and dad did, you know. Mm-hmm. So later in life, you might decide, you know, you want to take up drinking to excess to change how you feel.
Mm. How much do you think this programming or this self-sabotage comes from self-worth or a worth issue?
I think so. That's a very good point. I think it's right at the core of it. When you think about it, you know, as you're growing up, you know, you go through a process of trial and error, and, you know, people that are bigger than you seem to have it all together. And so, you know, it's very easy to end up with a negative self-image as a teenager. Mm-hmm. So think, you know, I'm sort of, I'm trying my best, and sometimes I get it right and sometimes I don't. And, you know, I do find this sometimes, people who, you know, who are very outwardly kind of confident, inwardly they're insecure because they're putting, you know, that as a front, you know. Those people who are happier in themselves, more comfortable in their own skin, find it easy to be authentic and to be vulnerable and to, you know, to realize that they're imperfect and accept that, you know. So I think you're right. It's an essential ingredient, if you like, in lack of self-esteem to just not value yourself.
What are some real life examples of self-sabotage that someone might not be realizing that they're doing?
So in self-sabotage, I'm also going to throw in imposter syndrome.
Okay,
that's very popular these days,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And what you have there is, with imposter syndrome, you've got people who are moving up, say, into a different position in their career.
Yeah.
Or they just starting a relationship and they think, oh God, I can't really be this good. I better get out before I'm found out. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, they're going to find out I'm not really that great. And that's sort of adjusting to new boundaries. Proper full-on self-sabotage. And the example I used earlier was, you know, the chap who got programmed by his mother to think that successful people would have heart attacks. Mm-hmm. In the same way, there's a lot of sort of cultural hypnosis too, you know, which is to do with... certainly, what's very interesting, you say rich people, fat cats, filthy rich, you know, that somehow if you're rich, you know, you must be a bad person and been a bit of a git to have achieved it, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of cultural hypnosis like that. But then there can just be things that happened in people's lives. There was a lady I worked with years ago, and she couldn't form a functional relationship. And we did a very simple process because it was part of a selecting unsuitable people, making sure it didn't work, because loved equaled pain, you know. And love has never hurt you, right? People have been unloving to you, but love has never come round your house and said, oi, do you want some, you know? So what I did with this lady was I got the part of her that wanted to have love and companionship and intimacy and all those great things, and the part of her that was protecting her. Right. Mm. And we get them together. And this is a really neat thing. The unconscious mind can make billions of computations in a few seconds and find ways for both of these aspects of the self to have their positive intent. Because sure, you can get to know somebody and maybe get to really like them and then fall in love. And you could do it incrementally. And at the same time, you know, not get damaged by it if you're sensible with it. You know, if you've got your protection mechanism there. And bam, she then writes to me a few months later and says, I'm in a fantastic relationship. Probably a coincidence. A few months later, she gets married. A few months later, she has a child. She says, do you think it could have anything to do with that process? I said, well, of course it is, you know. Because, see, to me, powerful change is another day at the office. But I understand to a lot of people, they think it's magic. And any significantly advanced technology is going to appear like magic to the uninitiated. Mm-hmm. And we're coming into an age now where, just remember, when I started in the 80s, hypnotherapy was voodoo, you know. And
really?
Oh my God, you know, when I people would say to me, it's dangerous and it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the thousands of research studies, the two things that come out of it is that it's very safe and it does work. Mm-hmm. And so we're now at a time where people are much more open to things like mindfulness, to sort of mental health, well-being, manifesting. You know, manifesting is a word, you know, that was in the woo-woo camp, you know, until a few. Now, of course, people see it as, you know, as an everyday word. You know, what am I going to make for breakfast? That's a form of manifesting. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm going to design a new business. That's a form of manifesting. So we're in an interesting time, Roxy, where we've got a lot of psychological and to some extent esoteric technology, which is being married with digital technology. So now, you know, on your phone, you can instantly call up a technique or a meditation or something like that to get you in a great place, you know, rather than have to go to a monastery and study for years.
So I have used hypnosis myself throughout my life to help me break free from particular self-sabotaging habits, for example, smoking. Mm-hmm. I used to smoke 25 a day. I went to go and see a hypnotist and I never smoked a cigarette since. And I've used it to help me with some limiting beliefs that I was struggling with. But a lot of people still don't really know what hypnosis is or how it works. And they think of someone turning into a chicken on stage and you know. But you are one of the world's leading hypnotherapists. And so who better to explain to us what really is hypnotherapy?
Okay, so hypnosis falls into three different camps. Some people say it's a special state of consciousness. Some people say it's just compliance because of the hypnotist's authority. And some people say, like me, it doesn't matter what it is because, you know, all I'm interested in is output. Is the person changing? So the labels are not important to me. But it was once described by Milton Erickson, who's the greatest hypnotherapist of the last century, as the loss of the multiplicity of the foci of attention. Now, that's typical Milton, creating a hypnotic induction out of an explanation, you know, because in order to make sense of that. So you lose the many things that you're focusing on, and you focus on one thing to the exclusion of all others. Mm. So the metaphor I would use would be when you watch television, you forget about the carpet, the curtains, you know, you suspend disbelief and you plug into the TV. Mm-hmm. So if something exciting happens, you feel excited. Mm-hmm. If something romantic happens, you know, you feel romantic. And in a sense, hypnosis is comparable to that. So the hypnotist gets your attention and then guides you into a more resourceful place. So for example, say you're frightened of public speaking. What the hypnotist would do is get you to remember times when you felt confident speaking to other people, you know, friends, not being judged, you know, and being authentic and natural, and then create what we call an anchor for that state of confidence and move it into imagining speaking to lots of people that you don't know and yet feeling that confidence and that authenticity. So a large part of what happens in hypnotherapy is done through visualization, because the language of the unconscious is symbology and, you know, and visualization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, athletes use this. They do a thing called mental rehearsal. They imagine, you know, running a race or winning a tournament over and over again. So they're training their mind and their muscle memory to be able to do that. So hypnotherapy is, in a sense, another word for thinking, right? Mm. Because all day long, we're talking to ourselves inside our mind. We're making movies in our mind. An example would be this. Somebody says to you, do you want to go to a party? Mm. And in a split second, you go, you imagine yourself there at the party. You don't know anyone. You're feeling awkward. And you say to yourself, don't know about this. So you go, no, I can't make the party. Or in a split second, something different. You run a different movie. You go, imagine you're hanging out and you're meeting people and it's fun and you think, this could be great. Yeah, what time's the party? So all day long, we're moving towards or away from things by the pictures and movies we make inside our mind and the way we make them and the things we say to ourselves constantly. And so what a hypnotherapist does is he puts, like a computer programmer, positive programs in there. So, for example, it's not just a case of telling somebody to stop smoking. You get them to imagine feeling calm and feeling good without cigarettes. And then you attach, you know, negative thoughts and feelings to the idea of where you end up if you continue smoking. And so really, in a way, a modern hypnotherapist is a bit like an interior decorator for your mind.
Oh, I like that description. But what happens at that point? So let's say, and actually I've got two questions for you. I don't want to forget them, so I'm going to say them both. One is, you use the term resourcefulness. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
Ah, right. Resourcefulness, resourceful states are things like resilience, confidence, creativity. You know, when you feel peaceful in yourself and you feel, you know, in control, that sort of stuff.
Right.
And unresourceful states are, say, unnecessary anxiety, anger, grief, things like that. Now, the thing is that things like fear and anger and grief are all necessary as part of our emotional intelligence. You know, if I'm about to step off the curb and there's a bus coming, I want some fear to pull me back and keep me alive, but I just don't want to live in it.
Yeah.
Same with anger. If somebody's, you know, mean to me, I say, hey, don't talk to me like that, but I don't want to live in that. And with grief, you know, if somebody we know passes, we should feel sad because, you know, how can we have any sense of value if not?
Mm-hmm.
So resourcefulness is when you're sort of in an optimal state of mind and body. So, you know, bad things can happen, but you're in a great place to deal with it.
Mm.
So in a sense, a large part of what a hypnotherapist does is, or a coach even, gets somebody into resourceful states of mind and body, whereby they can handle problems and challenges.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, if say every, you know, major athlete in the world now has somebody like me work with them, a success coach, you know, hypnotherapist or modern psychologist, the thing they want to be is in the zone. You know, at the moment they walk out into the stadium at the Olympics and there's a billion people watching them on television, they want to be in resourceful state and they want to feel fantastic. Because the difference between a medal and an also-ran is less than 1%.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I mean by resourceful states.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you. And for that person that it was scared of public speaking, and you give them this new visualization to imagine themselves, you know, speaking confidently on stage, not being judged, feeling at ease with it. You've done that visualization with them. How does that actually translate for them then in the real world?
There's a great saying by my friend Richard Bandler, which is disappointment requires adequate planning. So in order to make yourself, you know, so again, as a hypnotherapist, I'm not concerned with why, I'm concerned with how. Right? Analysts want to know why, you know, you're upset or why this happened. We're interested in how is it you make yourself unconfident and nervous before you go and speak publicly. Well, you run a movie in your mind of you getting up and speaking and drying up and, you know, and fumbling your words and everybody laughing. And, you know, and as you, when you run that several times, it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is how people make themselves scared of flying. You know, they imagine before they even got on the plane, you know, crashes and all sorts of terrible things. And so if somebody's running movies that are unhelpful, you change the movie, right? And you know, you make it so that first of all, it goes exactly the way they want it, but also you make the movie that if it doesn't go exactly the way you want it, you still stay in a resilient place, so you're able to handle whatever happens to you.
And what's the difference between somebody doing a visualization at home as opposed to doing it under a hypnotic state with a therapist?
Yeah. Okay. So the thing is, when somebody just sits and visualizes, you know, which is what we all do all day long, right?
Yeah.
There really isn't a big difference between doing that and doing it with a hypnotherapist, except a skilled modern hypnotherapist will be able to map how it is, how you're, you know, visualizing and upsetting yourself or holding yourself back, you know. Oh, no, I don't know if I could, you know, handle more success because it might mean too much, you know. I'm not really up to it, you know, visualizing that sort of stuff. So a skilled hypnotherapist firstly interrogates how it is that you're stopping yourself, holding yourself back, etc., and then builds a new set of visualizations and then puts them into the unconscious through the hypnotic concentration, if you like, and also through the language, right? So hypnotists use a particular kind of language which is quite powerful. It's used also by politicians and by salespeople, and you know, they all have. If you look at the structure of any professional communicator, there, the content might be different, but the structure is fairly similar. So, as a hypnotist, I use a lot of assumptions, presuppositions. You know, so I don't know how good you're going to feel during this experience. You know, and when you hit lots of presuppositions in a row, the way that the brain makes sense of that is it goes on what's called a transderivational search. And if you hit three in a row, it's just really hard for the brain not to accept it. So sitting and visualizing, in answer to your question, stuff, is what people do all day long, but they're often unconscious of it. When you're at a point in your life where there's a problem, you know, something you want to change, a behavioral change, hypnotherapist can find out what it is you're doing, how you're doing it, that's upsetting you or stopping you. And if you put, if you like, puts in a new program where you imagine, I'll give you an example. There was a famous theater actress came to see me years ago and she said, I'm getting stage fright. And I went, but hang on, aren't you supposed to be like one of the best? And she said, oh no, when you get to my stage, the pressure's even greater. And I said, so, okay, if I'm going to sit in for you for the day, how do I make myself frightened? She goes, well, I walk out onto the stage in the West End and I think he's a critic. And then I imagine he's writing something negative about me. And then I make a mistake and then he's writing even more stuff. And it's a self-reinforcing loop. So I said, oh, so you're good at hallucinating these, you know, critics criticizing you. So what we did was in the privacy of her imagination, we imagine walking out onto the stage and the critics going, what a fine veteran of this noble profession, you know. And she made a mistake. It doesn't matter. What a fine recovery that was, you know. So whatever happened, she was telling herself a new story and imagining a new story.
Yeah. It's so funny because I do a lot of public speaking and it's a big part of my job and I absolutely love it. And it's probably when I feel most confident. But I was in Belgium just before Christmas. And Marie Diamond was in the front row.
Love her.
And she was one of the first people to really talk about, well, she spoke about manifestation in The Secret, you know, the movie. So she's like one of the OGs. And I'd never met her before. And she'd come up to me before and said, so nice to meet you. And she's in the front row. And all of a sudden, I felt more nervous than I have in the 5 years I've been speaking on stage. And it was such a kind of thing that really, if I think about it now, what I was imagining in my head was, oh, she's judging me.
Yeah.
Oh, which of course, like, why would she was so lovely? But in my head, I thought, God, she thinks I'm shit. It was that imposter syndrome. And honestly, I probably gave one of my worst keynotes that I've given. And it was so because the way that you feel about something, the visualizations you have, the narrative you're telling yourself, the movies in your mind, as you put it, they do absolutely become self-fulfilling prophecies. You're so right. And it really does impact your performance.
Do you know, I've asked many people this over the years, you know, have you ever been starstruck, right? And some of the stories are really funny, you know, because in that moment, suddenly, you know, like Bill Bailey told me when he was doing a gig and Chrissy Hynde was in the audience. And when she came to meet him afterwards, he said his voice went up about 10 octaves, you know. And I'm thinking Liz Hurley said when she met Sean Connery, he was, you know, very charismatic, handsome man. And she couldn't think of anything to say. She just went, you're very Scottish. And, you know, things like this. So we've all done it, you know. Everyone's had that experience of going, oh, my God, you know. And I don't think it's a bad thing because – in a way, it's your mind, you know, sort of finding the boundaries again. If it happens all the time, it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
But every now and again, to be a bit sort of, wow, oh my God, you know. That's
humbled.
Humbled, that's it, yeah.
Yeah. So what is, if we come back to kind of what you said at the beginning, what really is the difference between somebody changing through willpower and someone changing through hypnosis?
Right, well, willpower is hard, right? Ask people about New Year's resolutions, you know. Willpower, that, you know, it's there's always some willpower required, right? But if all you have is willpower, very often you'll find it a struggle. What you need to do is to program the unconscious mind to make it so that it's easy, right? So say, for example, I do this demonstration where I say, you know, who's addicted to chocolate, you know? And, you know, there'll always be somebody, yes! I'll say, you know, I used to do this on television. We would get their favorite bar of chocolate out. And I'll go, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you want that? And as I'm unwrapping it, you know, the sound of the wrapper, they go, 10, I want it, right? And what they've got there is a compulsion. Now, if you try and override that just with willpower, it'll be too hard, right? Mm-hmm. So what I say is there a food that, you know, you find really revolting? And so I create a repulsion. Mm-hmm. And they go, yeah, chopped liver. And I'll go, now, in your mind, imagine biting into your favorite chocolate, but it's mixed in with chopped liver. So you're mixing compulsion with repulsion, mm-hmm. and one cancels out the other. And so when they look at chocolate in future, they don't have to, they haven't suddenly got the compulsion neurochemistry going on, right? They can take it or leave it. And that to me is freedom. So that's the difference between, say, willpower and programming.
Mm. I think it's really, really important for people, because I know that so many people judge themselves for not being able to commit to a change, for not being able to commit to a new habit. And I think that self-judgment is, you know, it's so damaging for someone's self-esteem. Mm. It really just makes things even worse. And so for somebody that's listening, that's sort of like, God, yes, that's me. I've been feeling so disheartened by my inability to stick to my resolutions this year or new habits. Yep. What's kind of like something you'd like to say to that person?
Well, first of all, if you've been finding something challenging, find a hypnotherapist, you know, or, you know, use, I put loads of my hypnotic trances up on my YouTube channel. You can use them for free, you know, and so you could try them out without any risk, as it were, you know, because if you've got 25 minutes to spare, see how, you know, how it changes you. So I do understand, though, that, see, if somebody has failed multiple times, they've got evidence, right? Mm-hmm. You know, this is part of the problem with the diet industry, or as I like to call it, the hate your body industry. And, you know, you're supposed to starve yourself, right? And of course, if you starve yourself, you'll end up binging. So some people can tough it out, you know, but the majority of people cannot. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, nobody puts on 5 stone overnight. It usually happens over a period of years where they go on a diet, they lose weight initially, and then they come off the diet, they fall off the wagon, and then they binge and they gain more weight. About 70% of people do. And so they've then got evidence that it can't be done, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know this, say when somebody now is labeled and they're medicated for that thing as well, they are convinced that is them. That's their identity. And so there are a lot of, you know, I'm not opposed to labels, but I think they're kind of overused. And people will tell me, they'll say things like, oh, I'm not artistic. And I'll say, how do you know? Well, they told me at school, you know, when I was a few years old. I went, oh, really? Right. And so, or people say, you know, I'm a shy person. And I say, yeah, you know, I used to be, actually. I was quite a nerdy, shy kid, you know. And then I got interested in hypnosis and I changed the way I think about myself and I don't feel that way anymore. And if I can do it, you know, you can do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I think that defining ourselves really blocks us from actually finding out who we are and all that we can be. I want to move on to abundance and the rich mindset.
Yes.
You know, you have a book on manifestation as well. Mm. And, you know, an abundant mindset is such a huge part of that.
Yes.
So you have studied lots of sort of high achievers and super successful people.
Yeah.
What patterns do you think they shared?
Well, what's really interesting was... So the best-selling self-help book of all time is Think and Grow Rich, mm-hmm. and it's about 80 years old. Mm-hmm. And a chap called Andrew Carnegie commissioned a guy called Napoleon Hill to go and study his rich and successful friends at the end of the last century and find out, you know, if they had similar mindsets. And basically, Think and Grow Rich is a book about subconscious reprogramming, mm-hmm. right? And it's not about rich and poor people. It's rich and poor thinking, right?
Yeah.
Poor thinking is coming out of lack all the time, running from lack. Ooh, I'll never have enough, right? Rich thinking is thinking in terms of possibility. Mm-hmm. And so I looked at this and I thought, you know, it's a good book, but I wonder if I could do better. Mm-hmm. And because we've learned a few things, you know, this was about 20 years ago. And I thought, so I'm going to make a study of rich people. Mm-hmm. And literally the next night, I was sat at a dinner party opposite Anita Roddick, the founder of The Body Shop. I'd always wanted to meet her. And I said, you know, Anita, I'm doing this thing. And I just wondered, she said, yes. I said, you haven't even heard what it is yet. She went, I don't care, I've got a vibe. I went, well, what it is I'd like to model you, study you, and find out your you know, your thinking patterns mm-hmm. around being rich. Because rich, by the way, is more than just money, right? That's, yeah. There are plenty of people. It was interesting. One of the people I studied, Sir David Barclay, who's no longer with us, he said, on this journey, Paul, you're going to meet people who are wealthy, but they're not rich, right? They're constantly running from poverty. You know, they don't have friends. They don't have much of a life. It's just, you know, they can never have enough money, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, Bob Marley famously said, some people are so poor, all they have is money, right? Mm. So, you know, anyway, it was as that once I committed, the universe kind of conspired in my favor. And I got a phone call from Sir Richard Branson. And he said, look, I'd like you to do an event for me. I went, yeah, certainly. He said, what are you going to charge me? I said, well, nothing. I said, if you let me study you, ask you questions about how you, you know, think rich. And I'm writing a book on this because I'm studying a whole load of, you know, rich people. And I wondered if you like it, if you wouldn't mind writing the foreword. He goes, if I like it, I will. And he did. And so at the end of this journey, my thinking around a rich life had changed. It was I've made loads more money, but it wasn't just that. You know, quality of my health, relationships, you know, career, everything. You know, was more abundant, was beautiful, and I changed my thinking from worry about, you know, lack into creative abundance. But also, what was interesting to me was all the various people I studied. They might have been in different businesses, but they had a similar strategy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for example, the story I love about Richard Branson was he's sitting on a plane in the 1970s when he's running his record company. And in those days, there was one TV in the center of the cabin, and these headphones were like something you'd have in a hospital, these awful great things that would go in your ears like this. And somebody had come along and throw something that looked like chicken in your lap, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And he thought to himself, he went, if I had an airline, right? So creative, yeah? If I had an airline, well, I'd put a TV in every seat. I'd have really high quality headphones. I'd have a lounge you look forward to going to. I'd improve the quality of the food. I'd, you know, all these things, right? So he went on this creative voyage, right? Dreamed up a business in his head. And then he did the important thing, which was took action, right? Because, you know, a lot of people think up things and then you go online or you open a magazine and someone else has done your idea. And the difference is they took action and you didn't, right? So he rings up Boeing and he says, I'm very interested in jumbo jet. And to buy one would have been so much money, he couldn't afford it. Mm. But he managed to find a way to lease it. And at the time, people said, what could somebody from the world of entertainment possibly bring to the airline industry? Mm. Well, as it happens, everything, right? Because everybody's copied his ideas now. Yeah. And so, you know, that mindset of thinking and designing, you know, inside your mind, they've all got this amazing potential to think outrageously, to think big, and also to take action and also learn from them, you know, from their mistakes. I mean, for example, if you were going into garden furniture, you know, one of the things that would be good to do is to look at the top three people in garden furniture and think, what is it they offer that makes them so successful? Because basically, you get rewarded for adding value, whether you have your own business or whether you work in a corporation or something. The more value you add, the more your perceived value, I should say, because supermodels are paid more than doctors because their perceived value is greater, right? But essentially, think to yourself, where can I add value? And you will be rewarded for it.
Mm. How does scarcity thinking show up in everyday behavior without people realizing it?
Well, you know, and again, people shouldn't beat themselves up for a bit of scarcity thinking. Because, you know, sometimes we've all suddenly got a bill and thought, how am I going to pay that? Or I've got to balance this if I'm going to do that, etc. And that isn't scarcity thinking. That's kind of just good economics. You know, and I, when I've worked with people who haven't been good at balancing the books, I get them to do an A, B, and C list. A list things are things you have to have, right? Like food, you know. B list things are important, but they're not essential. And everything else is a C. So you always concentrate on the A's. And if you've got money left over, you go to the B's. Scarcity thinking, and you know, you can meet people who are wealthy, but they never stop to enjoy it. They're always, they can't have enough money. You know, they're obsessed with so you notice, people say to me, it says in the Bible that money is the root of all evil. Well, it doesn't. It says the love of money, right? Treating money as a commodity, hoarding it is the root of all evil. And that kind of, that greed, that avarice, you know, is part, that's all tied up with scarcity thinking. Mm. Yeah, abundant thinking is when you, this is one of the things that I get asked, Roxy, is which, what's the simplest thing I can do with the biggest return? And I go, gratitude list. Yeah. You know, I go out for a walk in the morning and I go, what am I grateful for? Because you always get more of what you focus on, right? Mm-hmm. So I go, my health, my friends and family, clean air, first cup of tea in the morning, my job, you know, all the people I'm going to meet and places I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. And so by doing that, I'm affirming abundance at the unconscious level. So I'm saying to my mind, bring me more of this. Mm-hmm. Scarcity thinking is, oh, there won't be enough, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, how am I going to survive?
Mm-hmm. I love that. Why do you think that so many people feel guilt around wanting more?
Right. Now, again, this can be conditioned in childhood. You know, when I was growing up, the clean plate club, as I like to call it, you know, was in full effect in my house. You know, my mother would say, come on, finish that on your plate, you know, and I would go, well, I'm full. You know? And that came out of sort of post-war rationing and things like that. The other place it comes from is this belief that somehow you're not worthy. You know, and this is very prevalent in our society, or it's bad and it's greedy to want too much, you know, and this is the other one, which is such a lie. You having more takes away from somebody else, right? Mm. Now, one of my friends the other day said, nobody needs to be a billionaire. And I went, hang on, somebody having $1 billion doesn't take away a cent from you. What it means is there's more money in the world. Money's the oil in the machine that allows the exchange of goods and services. If you and I sit here and we pass a dollar bill back and forth between us, we could spend $1 million, right? So it allows for, because there are more people in the world, there are more goods and services and more innovations all the time. So we need more money to be able to oil the machine. So money in itself is, isn't inherently good or bad, but some people have, you know, grown up, you know, around people who think that it's the root of all evil, or causes arguments, or, you know, these sorts of things. And it's funny. I suppose, again, it's not bad. You're not a bad person to have those beliefs, but they're not, if they're not supporting you, they're not good beliefs to have.
Absolutely. Let's move on to manifestation a little bit more.
Yes.
So can you explain the science behind manifestation?
Sure. So in a simple sense, it's a thought that brings something into being. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so thoughts create the world, right? A simple manifesting is, you know, what am I going to have for breakfast? The bigger thing is, what kind of business am I going to start, right? Mm-hmm. There's something called the law of sympathetic resonance, which means that if you have two pianos in the same room, you hit the C chord on one, the C chord on the other vibrates in resonance, right? And this is how all the happy, lucky people find each other, because they're in resonance with each other. And all the miserable bastards find each other as well, because, you know, misery loves company. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to look at the universe just for a second, as, say, from a quantum point of view, you, me, this table, cameras, everything, is all atoms and molecules vibrating at a density and frequency, right? It's just, this microphone is a different density and frequency to the chair and to me, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why it's a mic, that's a chair, and that's a me, yeah? But in a sense, it's everything is energy. That's what Einstein said. Everything is energy, right? Einstein was a manifester in my mind. So people say, so what you're saying is, if you're a good person, you know, good things happen to you, right? And I say, no. Yes, it's more likely to, right? But nice people get cancer and villains have their own super yachts, right? The way I look at karma, right, is that it's you pull to you those things you need to learn. Now, if I think about some of the things that have happened in my life, some of the bad things, I wouldn't have signed up for them, but there was always a gift and a learning in it. And by the way, even if I'm wrong, that's a functional way to think, because otherwise you're going to be a victim, yeah, or the victim mindset. So to me, manifesting is creating, right? You cannot not be creative, right? It's just impossible, right? Even if you're doing nothing, you're creating nothing, right? So everything you do all day long, you're manifesting. If you're driving a car, you're manifesting a journey. You know, if you're having a conversation, you're manifesting a debate, et cetera, et cetera. But some people are really good at it. And some people are not. See what happened, actually. It was a friend of mine. He said to me, he goes, he's an American life coach. He said, I notice you get a lot of what you want, right? I went, yeah, actually, I do. I pretty much everything I want, I hadn't thought about it. He says, and you manifest, right? I said, yeah, but I don't call it that because isn't it a bit woo-woo? He went, come out of the closet. And admit you're a manifester, right? So I did, and I thought, you know, I looked at the way a lot of people manifest, which is two-dimensionally, and that's writing down goals or a vision board. And that works, right? There's nothing wrong with that, right? Some people do it three-dimensionally. They imagine they're there and they've achieved their goal. What do they see? What do they hear? What do they feel? Yeah? They're telling the unconscious, give me this. The way I like to do it is four-dimensionally. So I do it in time-space. So I travel out, say, 1 year into the future, and I imagine my life as it is, perfect, the way I want it to be. And then I step back 3 months, 3 months, 3 months until I get back to now. Then my mind has got a clear route to going and achieving that. And at the same time, I might think, what could stop me? And also I do something called an ecology check, which is the study of consequences. So did I burn myself out doing this? Did I upset people? Did I, you know what I mean? So I'm checking it's got integrity, the you know, the direction I'm going in. So that's the way I like to manifest. And it's something that everybody's doing. And you know, the thing is, like anything, if you, what you practice, you get good at, you know? And so, you know, both of us have had success in manifesting and obviously wanted to encourage other people to do the same.
Why do you think some people, let's say they'll say, you know, I feel like really good at manifesting in my career, but in my love life, I find that so hard.
Yeah.
What's happening there?
Right. They've got a block. That's all it is, you know? And by the way, again, don't beat yourself up. If you're one of those people who, you know, I find perfectionists are like this, you know, they're really good, you know, say the career, but they just can't make, say, relationships work. And sometimes they're using the same strategy that they would use for career advancement in their relationships. And they're not necessarily, they don't necessarily work in the same way. But very often there's a block, right? And it'll be at the unconscious level, so you won't know why, right? I just keep picking the wrong kind of person. Or it always ends in the same kind of way. And that's a block. And there's so many great ways to, you know, to remove a block and to stop self-sabotage or holding yourself back or not achieving your true potential. You know, when I ask people, you know, I'm in a group and I say, who here is at 100% of their true potential? Nobody ever says yes, right? Now, the good thing is that means there's always room for improvement.
Yeah. And of course, hypnosis, I suppose, can be one of those ways that you
hypnosis is and block. NLP. Yeah. There's a really great techniques, NLP techniques for overcoming blocks that work real quick.
Should we try one of them?
Yeah. What? So you want to remove a block?
Yeah, go on then. Let's do
it. Now, this is the neat thing. You don't have to tell me what the block is, right? Okay. And in fact, people watching or listening at home, they can do this, provided, you know, if it's, I'm going to ask you to close your eyes, but only do it if it's safe to do so. So I'd like you to think about a particular area of your life where you're blocked. You don't have to tell me what it is, but you've got to be able to recognize it and label it. And when you think of the block, right, what comes to mind? If you close your eyes, how does it represent?
I feel like a black long thing in me.
Yeah, okay. Now, so come on back out. So the language of the unconscious is symbology, right?
Right.
And so some people go, it's a wall. It's a mountain of sludge, something like that. So we're going to do two things here, right, on your block.
Okay.
Right. Now, the first thing is I'm going to ask you to run your hands down here like that, okay? Now, what this does is this produces a delta wave. And we do this in two techniques, yeah? So it feels nice, doesn't it? Mm, comforting.
Goosebumps.
Yeah. Because when you were a baby, your mother held you in her arms and you're hardwired to release delta, which feels really nice. So I'm going to ask you to close your eyes now and focus on the block, but keep stroking the side of your arms. A downward stroke, that's right. That's it. And tell me, on a scale of 1 to 10, how strong is that block?
Right now?
Yeah. Get it as strong as you can.
Oh, okay. Okay, like an 8.
An 8. Mm-hmm. Now, keep stroking the side of your arms, concentrate on the block, concentrate on the block, and now clear your mind. Clear your mind, keep stroking the side of your arms, and we're going to walk on a beach together. Mm-hmm. And with each footstep that you take in the sand, count out loud from 1 to 20, please.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20.
Keep stroking the side of your arms. That's right. Now, I'd like you to remember a happy time, any happy time, and return to it now like you're back there again. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you can see, hear, and feel.
I'm with my sister and our kids on New Year's Eve dinner, and there was this pink blue sky behind us.
Oh, wow. And you have a good feeling in your body right
now. Yeah.
Whereabouts is it strongest?
In my chest.
In your chest. Give it a color, any color you like, a nice color.
Lilac.
Yeah, lilac. Move that color up through your chest into your neck, all the way around your head. And then imagine moving that color down through your shoulders, into your arms and hands and fingers, down through your chest, into your legs, to the tips of your toes, and double the brightness. And then double it again until you're glowing with this beautiful lilac feeling. And then we're going to take 10 paces on a summer's day in a beautiful garden and count out loud with each pace that you take.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 10.
Now, stop for a second. Where's the block now on a scale of 1 to 10?
0.
0. Right. Now, one more part to this. Okay.
Okay.
If you can place your hands out in front of you with your palms facing up, please. That's right. There you go. Mm-hmm. So if you put them in front of you. Now, just in case there's any block left, right, I want you to put the part of you that, I want you to put the block. Because it will have had a purpose, right? It will have been, say, overprotecting you or something like that. Mm-hmm. Put the block in one of your hands, your left or right hand, and just show me which hand it's in. Mm-hmm. There it is. Now, I want to say to the block, thank you for doing all the good things that you do for Roxy, right? But I'd like you to continue to do those good things. Maybe it's protection or something like that. But just in future, by not holding her back or blocking her so she can succeed and achieve in this area of her life where she wants to. And in theory, is that possible? And what does the block say?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Now, on the other hand, I'd like you to put the part of you that wants to succeed and achieve in this particular area, right? Mm-hmm. And put it and get a sense of what that success is going to look like, sound like, and feel like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be amazing. Get a really strong sense. Now, the next bit of magic, bring your two hands together. So one is over the top. Oh, that's it. Okay, like that. And let these two parts at the unconscious level work out how it is that they're both going to fulfill their positive intent. So the part of you that wants to succeed and achieve can do that. And the part of you that's holding you back or blocking you, whatever it's doing at a positive level, it can continue to do that. And when it feels like both these parts of you can work together, there'll be like a moment of, yeah, it's possible. Yeah. And as soon as you get that moment, tell me yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, gently pull your hands towards you. That's right. There you go. That's it. And then put them together and then push them towards your heart. That's it. Yeah. That's it. What will you see, hear, and feel when you're succeeding and achieving the way you want to, and yet the old part that was blocking you or stopping you is still able to do the positive aspects of its job, but it's not blocking you in the way it was before. That's right. See it, hear it, feel it. And then when you're ready, open your eyes and come on back out.
Wow. That was amazing.
So tell me, when you think about this area now, what's the difference?
Oh, I feel really excited. Yeah. And that's been a big block for me
right. For
a long time. It's around love.
Right. There was a change in your energy, you know, halfway through that.
Yeah.
Don't be too surprised.
Yeah.
What kind of, you know, different things begin to happen now for you.
Watch out, boys. That was so good.
Thank you.
Also, I was really surprised by the instant colors that came up.
Yes.
Like the black was so instant. Mm-hmm. And then it really did, when I said not, it really was gone because the lilac, which is also, I am not a fan of purple in general, but that was the color that came up for me.
You know, at that point, I think that the block was gone, but I, you know, like to gild the lily, as it were.
Oh, God, yeah.
And so, you know, the next bit gives you a very strong sense of the possibility.
It really put me into that visualization of what that could feel like again and the excitement around it. Thank you.
Very welcome.
Wow. You often say you run your own brain, which I love. What does that look like in daily life?
Well, when you're running your own brain rather than your brain running you, right? So the problem is these days, a lot of people since the pandemic have gotten very good at catastrophizing. Mm-hmm. And in fact, anxiety is everywhere as a result. You know, you turn on the TV or open a newspaper, you're under attack. It's the war, it's the virus, it's the economy, it's something, right? And so people, when they're not running their own brain, their brain is not in them, allow, you know, themselves to think, hang on, what if this time? And literally terrify themselves. Mm-hmm. Mark Twain famously said, I've been through some terrible experiences and some of them actually happened, right? So I meet people all the time, you know, in their head catastrophizing about emergencies that are never going to occur. You know, another way of you running your own brain is, again, you know, holding yourself back. I wrote a book about 20 years ago about confidence. And I interviewed this guy the other day. That's right, he interviewed me for a radio interview. And he said, I've got to tell you, I bought your book on confidence, right? And I said, oh, yeah. Was it helpful? He said, well, there was a girl at the radio station where I work. And I just kept telling myself, oh, she wouldn't be interested in me. And he said, and I changed the self-talk, right? And I said, what happened? He said, we've been married 15 years, right?
Aww.
So fantastic. So these are examples of how you can run your own brain. I mean, most people spend more time making a list for the supermarket than they do the next year or 5 years of their life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, setting off in a boat without a rudder would be a bad idea, which is kind of what a lot of people are doing. So I'm a big fan of having a direction. I like goals, but, you know, you sometimes need more than just goals because, you know, my life used to be about goals to the extent of everything else. And so if I didn't achieve what I wanted when I wanted to, I could get very upset and frustrated, you know, and sort of stop and go, wow, I've got so much to feel good about. Mm. So, you know, I think those are examples of you running your own brain rather than it running you.
Yeah. You mentioned anxiety there. Mm-hmm. I think it's something more and more of us are experiencing, or we're just more aware of the experience of it, you know. And I'm definitely super aware of my emotional state all the time. So I can feel when something has instantly triggered that feeling in me. Mm. What is actually happening in the body when someone feels anxious?
Right. So we have a mechanism called fight or flight. So an ancestral thing where you had to, as a caveman or woman, you know, fight a wild animal or another cave person or run away. And so when you go into fight or flight, what happens is lactic acid is released into the system, immune system suppressed, digestion suppressed, blood is pumped to the limbs, you know, so you can fight or run away, right? Now, the thing is, if you're in a real life, you know, dangerous situation, that's a good thing to have. Mm-hmm. But the trouble is that is being triggered way too often all day long, you know, you're caught up in traffic, get into an argument, late for a meeting. And so what we're doing is we're triggering to a lesser extent that survival mechanism. And so what's happening is people are getting overly stressed. In fact, 50% of the reason why people end up at the doctor these days can be traced back to stress. Mm. And so anxiety, do you know, the thing about anxiety is people who are anxious are generally they're achievers. They're perfectionists. You know, they worry a lot about stuff, but it's at the cost of them enjoying things, right? Mm. Because thinking about everything could go wrong. And so I like to get people who are anxious into a place where they don't lose any of their edge, But at the same time, they're not overwhelmed with fear. So they've got, they're in a place I call relaxed alert, you know. So, which is a nice place to be, you know. And so you feel in control and you're not overwhelmed by it. But there's basically too much of it. We've come out of a biological pandemic. We're in a psychological pandemic now. And a lot of that is fueled by our media and the mindset that people train themselves to get into during the pandemic.
It's so funny. I remember my dad saying to me, I was talking to him about my anxiety sort of about a couple of years ago. And he said, your anxiety is what makes you so successful. And I thought, what a strange thing to say. But now I kind of get it. Not that it was helpful to have the anxiety, but perhaps, you know, there was some benefit for it for a small amount of time.
Sure.
But now I think I've reached that state that you said, which is alert, but not anxious all the time. What do you think is a simple technique that a listener can use if they find themselves in an anxious state?
In an anxious state, you know, the thing we just did.
And I'll say to anybody listening, do this now if you can, because don't try and find this technique in the moment you're anxious. Practice it now.
Yes.
And then you have it ready to go when you feel anxious.
There's one that's used by all four divisions of the American military. And if you find yourself anxious, if you think about something that makes you anxious, right? You do that right now. Immediately put your hand on your heart and then take a slow in-breath and hold it and gently let it go. And then you take a slow in-breath and you gently let it go. And on the third slow in-breath, if it's safe to do so, close your eyes, let that breath go, and remember a happy time, any happy time, like you're back there again now. See what you saw, hear what you heard, and feel how good you felt. And ask your heart, which is really the second brain, is there anything that you need to know to be aware of? What would be helpful to know in this moment? And then when you're ready, come on back out. So that is something that people use when they're in overwhelm in the American military. Now, when you think about that thing that was making you anxious, what's the difference?
I have a sense of calm around it. I always know when something's calming me because I always want to take a deep breath. And as soon as I did that, I had a sigh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Incredible. Thank you so much. I feel healed. You wrote a book that was sort of one of the great self-help books, which was Change Your Life in 7 Days. And that was 25 years ago. And you've now just updated it. Two questions is, why do you think it resonated so much with people? And why are you updating it now?
Well, there hadn't been a book like that at the time, right? There were lots of psychobabbly self-help books. But I wanted to write one that was almost like common sense, you know, and with practical psychology. So I took bits of NLP and all the sorts of, you know, things that I thought were common sense that people should be doing, like, you know, the movies in your mind and, you know, and being clear about having goals and, you know, and stepping into a you that was more confident, these sorts of things. Yeah. And I what I did was I put a CD in. It was really hard to persuade the publisher to do this. But I put a CD in the back with a hypnotic trance in it. So not only would people read the book, but they then use the trance. And if you do anything for 7 days, you're going to be different, right? And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if, you know, got on the bestseller list, you know, and it did, you know, and it started going higher and higher and it smashed number one all over the world. And my publishers called me in and they said, you're not going anywhere, mate. You know, we want a few more of these. And I said, well, I'm really a talker. I'm not a writer. They went, no, you're a writer now. So what happened was about a year ago, my publishers came to me and said, you know, Change Your Life in 7 Days. You're still selling really well. I went, well, that's great. You know, if that's what I'd intended was to write something that was evergreen.
That is kind of mad, isn't it? Like 25 years later, it's still, like, I see it on every bookshelf and every self-help section. And to think that's like a quarter of a century.
I know,
it's kind of cool.
Well, thank you. I feel the same way, you know. And there isn't a week that goes by that somebody doesn't either come up to me in the street or write on social media, this was the book that changed it all for me. And when that, so the publisher said to me, think about updating it. And I said, well, let me read it first, because I haven't read it in a couple of decades.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, the integrity of the, not bad for a book of its own. I'm quite pleased with that. But I went, I would change this, or I would say it like this, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I went through the whole thing and updated it. And nowadays, you don't have a CD in the back of the book. Mm-hmm. You do audio downloads. So I thought, why don't I make every technique and a few others into audio techniques. You can download 22 techniques onto your phone. So if you need confidence, bam, you hit that button and I pop out and put you in a confident mindset, you know, something like
that. Brilliant.
Yes. So it isn't just a book. It's a sort of, it's an audio system as well.
Yeah.
And
I bet the publishers loved it because they didn't have to spend money on an extra CD.
Exactly. Oh, no, they love that. Definitely. So anyway, it was one of these things where, It was really because I felt quite excited about it. You know, I mean, I'm in sure like you these days, I only work with people I like and I do things that I like, right? And so I got excited about it. And I went, yeah, there's a whole generation of people that will not have read this book. Mm-hmm. And certainly now in the digital information age, you know, I can impart the techniques in audio to people as well. So that's it. We've put it out. And I think a lot of my fan base will probably already have read it, right?
Yeah.
But there'll be a whole load of people who never did.
Absolutely.
And will go, I might give this a go. Mm. And, you know, it's something that I hope will continue for many, many years to help people change their lives for the better.
Absolutely. Well, if you are listening, do go and get Change Your Life in 7 days. Paul, I have a quick fire round for you before
sure.
we leave. Okay, what's the first habit you would change or add in someone's life?
The ability for people at will to put themselves in deep, peaceful, calm feelings. Because right now there's just too much fear-based aggression and, you know, all sorts of anxiety in the world. Mm-hmm. So if people at will could just bam, make themselves feel calm, mm-hmm. and they'd be able to make better decisions. It'd be better for their health as well. Mm-hmm. That would be the one thing.
Absolutely. What's the biggest lie our minds tell us every day?
Ooh, that's a tough one, isn't it? I think at the moment, if we're massively generalizing here, right? But there are too many people telling themselves that we're under attack, that the world's going to end, it's all terrible. Mm. Sure, there are absolutely problems in the world, right? There's no doubt, all kinds of different problems. But there's too much unnecessary anxiety caused by this continual kind of a commentary that is catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a phrase or thought you use to reset yourself?
Oh, sure. Well, do you know, there's one I love by Sid Banks, the philosopher. He says, you're only ever one thought away from happiness.
Mm.
Right? I mean, the thing I live by also is you get more of what you focus on.
Yeah.
You know, and so if I'm feeling a bit down about something, maybe I'm worrying too much about something, you know, I mean, I'm not perfect. I still, you know, have problems and challenges. But the reset is to, hang on, what am I focusing on here?
Mm-hmm. What's the number one thing you see holding people back?
The number one thing that holds people back, well, it's themselves. And also, this is the really interesting thing. People either don't think big enough, right? Mm. Because they're frightened too. Or, you know, they think that they, you know, because they think they won't be able to handle it if they achieve more. And also, it's subconscious programming that they've picked up in the formative years of their life, you know, where they feel sort of things like shame or fear or guilt or you know, any of those sort of uncomfortable emotions that hold them back. And that, again, is childhood programming.
Yeah. One key lesson from your book that everyone can take on board or should take on board.
Well, I'm going to come back to the gratitude list.
Yeah.
Is you know, that's the thing that will make a big difference. If you do it religiously, like I go for a walk with my wife and, you know, we look at in nature, it's really nice. Mm. And just think about all the things we're grateful for, big and small. Mm. And then if I'm feeling a bit flat, I just go back and read through the list and it picks mm-hmm. me up.
And lastly, what does rising mean to you?
Well, do you know, what just came into my mind there was, you know, when you wake up feeling really good, you've had a good night's sleep and the sun's coming up and you know, you're rising and you feel this sort of sense of opportunity, right? And see, some people get up and they move away from fear, right? They get up and they think, oh, I better not be late because then I might get in trouble, I might get sacked. And so they're using fear and anxiety to motivate themselves. So they're moving away from. I like to move towards. So I'm thinking, wow, what will this day bring, this beautiful day? Do you know, I was reading, it was an interview with Steven Spielberg the other day, and he said, some mornings I'm so excited I can't eat my breakfast, right? And I read that, I thought, that's a move towards guy, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's someone who's thinking, wow.
Yeah.
So rising to me is that like beautiful feeling of opportunity, of positivity, of possibility that we all have in our lives at some point more than others.
I love that. Paul, thank you so much for being a guest on Rise with Roxy.
Thank you, Roxy. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Wow, I absolutely loved that episode with Paul. Firstly, I just think he really is like one of the self-help book OGs, in my opinion. And so it was such an honor to have him here. I love how he really reiterated the importance of visualization, the power of our inner critic, our minds. And I think whenever I'm reminded about that, I always feel empowered because I realize that actually I have so much influence over how I feel, over what I attract into my life. And I think it can benefit everyone. I also cannot tell you genuinely how good I felt from those exercises that he did, the visualizations. It was only like a couple of minutes or a minute at most. And yet I felt so good and I felt this kind of like weight lift from me. So yeah, I hope you guys tried it. And if not, definitely get his new book. I love that it comes with all that, those audio recordings as well. Let us know what you thought. Leave a comment, share it on social media at Rise with Roxy, and I will see you for the bonus episode very soon.
A Rayo Original Podcast.